climate isn't weather. But the unpredictable storms and rising temperatures that come with climate change are making it tough on farmers.
The weather is crazy. You know, sure, I get it. Weather changes and it's variable, but not to that extreme.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how climate change is affecting local growers. Plus, there are some disagreements about the best way to keep pollution out of the Chesapeake Bay. But cleaning up local streams isn't one of them.
There's no reason for us to stop any of that work. And in fact, we need to double down on that work.
And we take a summertime hike to a place where cold air rises right out of the rocks, like nature's refrigerator. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania has issued a do not eat advisory for all game fish on the Shenango River in the western part of the state because of PCBs. The state found extremely high levels of the toxic chemicals in routine tissue samples of fish taken this year. Neil Shader, spokesman for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, says drinking water facilities along the river are keeping an eye on PCB levels in the water.
None of their monitoring has shown any sign of PCBs. All the tests came back as non-detect, which means if there's anything there, it's at a level that it's too low to pick up.
The Shenango is a tributary of the Beaver River, which feeds into the Ohio. The affected stretch of river is near a Westinghouse Superfund site that used PCBs until the 1970s. Well, journalist Dan Fagan knows a little something about industrial pollutants in rivers. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Tom's River, Fagan uses history, personal narrative, health data, and investigative journalism to tell the story of a small town's long struggle with chemical pollution, which led to one of the largest settlements for toxic dumping in the U.S. Fagan will be in Pittsburgh on September 7th. I spoke with him by phone about the book and what we can learn now from Tom's River. Tom's River was a small town and river, literally a backwater, you say in the book, near the Jersey Shore. And in the 1950s, the chemical dye manufacturing industry set up shop there. So for people who haven't read the book, can you describe what happened next?
Yeah, well, you set it up really well. I originally set out to write a book about, you know, this particular factory in a particular town and the environmental consequences thereof. But what I discovered is that by the time the chemical industry came to Tom's River, there had been more than a century of experience, very bad environmental experience, in terms of polluting drinking water and also air emissions from these dye plants. And sure enough, that's what happened in Tom's River too. The first thing that was contaminated were the chemical plant's own water wells. But instead of fixing the problem in a fundamental way by improving pollution control, they simply relocated their wells to a place where they wouldn't be affected and just kind of took no notice of the fact that these chemical pollutants were seeping toward the main water supply wells, the public water supply wells of the entire town. And it's, you know, to this day, we don't really know what all was in that wastewater, but certainly it was enough to have some significant toxic effects on wildlife and also on the people who drank that water.
SIBA, the dye manufacturer, which became Tom's River Chemical and eventually produced other chemicals there out of really hazardous materials, originally operated in the U.S. on the Ohio River in Cincinnati. And in some ways, it's a familiar story, you know, a polluting industry and the environmental and health consequences for people who live nearby. How is Tom's River unique, and how is it similar to other places in the country that have, you know, industrial polluters?
I actually think it's quite similar to many other places. I mean, one of the truly unusual things about Tom's River is that we really know what happened now, because there was so much elaborate study both of the pollution and of the health effects of that pollution. And in most other places, we don't know that. However, on the Ohio River, where this particular operation was before it moved to Tom's River, we also have really excellent and really shocking documentation of the extent of the pollution and also the extent of the cancer clusters among employees of Cincinnati Chemical. And yes, they moved to Toms River because they wanted a place that was relatively isolated, where there would not be a lot of people sort of poking around and seeing what was going on.
Eventually, over the course of several decades, some people did start to question the chemical company. They went around the types of inquiry by, I think eventually they started piping the waste directly into the ocean. How did what they were doing become public knowledge? How was that investigated and brought to light?
You know, the first way that it came to light was that some people, relatively small number of people, were concerned about the construction of that waste pipeline that you mentioned. And they start asking questions, why is this pipeline necessary? And a few of them actually discovered that it was because the public drinking water wells at Toms River had been affected by this contamination. But the chemical company and the water company did a very good job of keeping the lid on that information. They were very vague and really misleading about what had actually happened to the public water supply. And then there was a leak in that pipeline a few years later, and that caused more people to ask questions. And then really in the 80s and 90s, when concerns about cancer clusters among employees and especially among children in the town became more prominent, concern began to grow. But what I found was truly shocking was that this process took so long, and there were so many people in town that were willing to just ride the wave. And the chemical company did a lot in the short run economically for Toms River. These were well-paying jobs. And it was really a place of upward economic mobility, upward social mobility. These folks thought they were living the American dream. And even though there were clear indications that there was a dark side to what was happening, many people chose not to pay attention.
Toms River Chemical engaged in some really underhanded practices. But you point out in the book that even the legal limits for waste they were releasing wouldn't be allowed now by EPA. That was a very different time. But is there a modern parallel?
Yes. Many of the things that Toms River Chemical did were legal at the time. Some things they did were not legal, and there were both civil and criminal prosecutions of the company over the years. Of course, it was a different time, and of course, environmental laws were more lax than they are now. We know much more now about this relationship between chemical exposures and public health. I think it's also quite relevant in places where regulation is still relatively lax. And of course, if folks who read the book know that the last chapter I go to China, which is really where the new Toms Rivers are. China now absolutely dominates the global chemical manufacturing industry. And sure enough, in China, many of the same mistakes and the same sort of civic movements to sort of try to understand the consequences of this manufacturing, that many of the same things that happened in Toms River and are now happening in China. And then finally, I think it's quite relevant to this current debate that we're having in the United States. I don't even know if I would call it a debate, but it's certainly a talking point among our current president, Donald Trump, and among many Republicans, that environmental regulation is a drag on economic growth. Toms River shows, you know, what the consequences of that can be. I mean, the folks, residents of Toms River, turned a blind eye to what was happening in their town because they wanted to enjoy the consequences of growth. In the long run, many of them came to regret it. They certainly regret it now, and they take a very different attitude in Toms River now.
Actually, Dan Fagan says, Toms River is now a lovely town because of everything they went through, and the chemical company is long gone. Dan Fagan is a journalism professor at New York University and director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program there. He's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Toms River. Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program is bringing Dan Fagan to Pittsburgh on September 7th for a talk and book signing. And there's more about that at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. The decades-long effort to clean up the Chesapeake Bay has been showing signs of success. some worried the progress would be hindered by budget cuts proposed by the Trump administration. Others are more concerned by a dam in northern Maryland. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports it's been holding back pollution for nearly a century, but scientists say it's filled up faster than expected.
The bright yellow neon sign reading Conowingo Hydroelectric Plant has been a landmark on top of the dam since it came online in the late 1920s.
Conowingo Dam is the largest source of renewable power in Maryland.
Colleen Hicks works for Exelon, which owns the dam. She explains how the Susquehanna River, the bay's largest tributary, turns its turbines, creating enough electricity for about 250,000 homes. Like all dams, this one has created a reservoir behind it. And as a side benefit, the reservoir keeps sediment from washing downstream, where it can harm aquatic life.
The river starts in Cooperstown, New York, and flows into the Chesapeake Bay.
In 2010, the EPA imposed strict new pollution limits on state and local governments. The goal is to sharply curb nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment by the year 2025. It was believed the Conowingo Dam would continue trapping sediment until then. But Bill Ball of the Chesapeake Research Consortium says scientists recently concluded the dam isn't trapping sediment like it used to.
It is now at a point where it's essentially effectively full. The capacity's been reached.
That's why Maryland just announced a $4 million pilot program to dredge behind the dam. Ben Grumbles heads the state's Department of the Environment.
If you don't deal with the sediment problem, you're going to have a really hard time meeting the more aggressive cleanup goals.
Grumbles says sediment is not the only problem. Controlling pollution before water even reaches the dam is critical. His counterpart to the north, Secretary Patrick McDonnell of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, says his agency will keep focusing on cleaning up local waterways.
There's no reason for us to stop any of that work. And in fact, we need to double down on that work and make sure we're dealing with our own impairments. In doing that, a lot of the bay piece, from our perspective, starts to take care of itself.
But Grumbles feels dredging is so important, Maryland might veto Exelon's pending application to relicense the dam if the company doesn't do enough to find a solution.
Our state has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make sure that as Exelon seeks a 46-year renewal of its license, that the state use its ability to negotiate with them.
Exelon says it supports efforts to find long-lasting solutions to deal with the sediment issue. But if the state calls for a larger-scale dredging operation, it's unclear how much of the tab the company would have to pick up.
We can't simply assume that we've got a spigot that we can turn off or not turn off by virtue of dredging.
Andy Miller, a professor with the University of Maryland, says this problem goes back centuries. In fact, research shows at one point farming and deforestation caused so much sediment to wash downstream, it added nearly 800 acres to Maryland. Miller says a major dredging operation now would be an expensive and temporary solution.
You bought yourself a short period of time, after which you'll be back in the same boat. That, to me, is not necessarily money well spent.
Besides the federal government, the District of Columbia and six states, including Pennsylvania, are all working together on many fronts to curb pollution from the 64,000-acre watershed. The Conowingo Dam is important, but Bill Ball of the Chesapeake Research Consortium says it's only one piece of a very big puzzle.
And it's important to separate the issues of who pays, where it's done, and what is done. So where it's done and what is done are science questions. Who pays is a political question.
With sediment now washing over the dam regularly, that political question has become a pressing matter. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Purple twin flowers started growing in a certain part of what's now West Virginia thousands of years ago.
Other things that were living here were caribou and ptarmigan, probably muskox, maybe even things like grizzly bears.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we hike back in time at Ice Mountain. I'm kind of getting chills just thinking about it. Stay tuned. Climate change is changing our food. A number of reports, including the recently released federal government assessment of climate science, all say that there will be winners and losers when it comes to farming. Production of some crops will increase and others will decline or need to switch locations. Julie Grant looks at what that might mean for food produced here in our region.
Farmer Matt Herbruck is glad he doesn't have to focus his vegetable crop on peppers again this year. In 2016, the weather was so hot and dry.
Sometime in June, I could clearly see that this was going to be one brutal summer.
He says temperatures were 5 to 10 degrees above average, and instead of the usual 12 inches of rain from May through August, they got only 2 inches all summer. It wasn't enough water to grow lettuce and leafy greens.
So we went big into peppers and eggplants and things like that. Unfortunately, peppers are really not the most lucrative crop, but we had a lot of them, so that was nice.
Herbruck has seen this trend of hot and dry weather, so a few years ago he added an irrigation system. But still, it wasn't enough.
Last year, it was so dry that the spring went dry. And so we didn't have any irrigation after about July. And so my yields were down by half or so last year. Yes, really terrible year.
For a small organic farmer, that's tough to overcome. After 22 years of farming, Herbruck says it's undeniable. The climate is changing and it's getting more extreme.
It's not unusual at all in this area to go from in the 40s one night to 90 36 hours later. It happens. And that's not normal. You know, the weather is crazy. And, you know, sure, I get it that weather changes and it's variable, but not to that extreme.
I hear a lot about that from our farmers.
That's Franklin Egan, Director of Education at PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. And he says it's more than just talk. He points to data from the USDA that show while the amount of annual rainfall in Pennsylvania and the Northeast U.S. has increased only slightly in the past 50 years, the way it's coming down has changed.
We've been getting a lot more extreme rainfall events.
More than an inch of rain in a day is considered extreme.
The amount of extreme rainfall we've gotten has increased fully 71%.
It's a startling number and a far bigger change than in any other part of the country.
And so if you put that together, you know, about the same annual rainfall, but more intense rainfall, that means that Pennsylvania farmers are dealing with this paradox of way too much water at certain points of the year, punctuated by short but often fairly intense drought periods.
And both extreme wet and dry weather can make farming less reliable. And yet, Pennsylvania's Agriculture Secretary, Russell Redding, says climate change isn't all bad for farms in the region.
I would say at this point that it is a mixed bag.
According to Pennsylvania's climate assessment, last updated in 2015, average annual temperatures have risen almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 100 years, and they're expected to warm another 5 degrees or more within the next 50 years. Those extreme rain events will get worse, and summer heat waves will get more frequent and intense, so places like Harrisburg would feel more like Birmingham, Alabama. But whether that's good or bad largely depends on what a farm produces. Dairy, poultry and eggs, corn, vegetables, nuts and fruits are all produced in Pennsylvania.
There are going to be winners in this conversation in terms of their ability to grow extended season and different crops, and there'll be a downside, because there's a lot of production agriculture that will not be able to tolerate the continued swings of rainfall and temperatures.
One example of that mixed bag, fruit. On the upside, Redding says, as the climate warms, new varieties of fruit are already being grown here.
There are peaches that are here today, experimentally, that are doing very, very well, that would have been a southern peach, meaning Virginia and further south, that are here today. We have apple varieties that would have been in the Shenandoah Valley, in Virginia, that are now in Pennsylvania. So they're real.
Redding says improved farming practices could also be driving the success of these new varieties. On the downside, the warming conditions are implicated in new unwanted pests. The Agriculture Department recently issued a quarantine in 6 counties to prevent the spread of the spotted lanternfly, a black, red, and white insect that first appeared in Pennsylvania and the U.S. just a few years ago. It could devastate the state's tree fruits and grapevines.
That becomes a major concern for us.
And the plant lanternflies need to complete their life cycle? It's another aggressive invasive that likes warmer temperatures, a tree called Tree of Heaven.
Is there a correlation between warmer temperatures and spotted lanternfly and Tree of Heaven? Yes, that's happening.
For many farmers, these unanticipated changes and all the variability mean they have to continually adjust their plans to suit the warming weather. Dairies are adding air conditioning to keep cows cool enough to produce milk. In fields, more are adding irrigation systems for dry periods, and more crops are being grown in hoop houses for better protection from weather and pests. Vegetable farmer Matt Herbrick says for years now, he's been shifting away from working the fields in July.
I just can't. Stuff doesn't grow that well, and also, I'm not going out there and it's 95 degrees. And who wants to do that?
But he also sees some benefits of climate change. Nowadays, October is still usually warm enough for planting, so he's still selling produce in November and December. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
In Hampshire County, West Virginia, just south of the Pennsylvania border, there's a small mountain ridge called Ice Mountain. Historical records suggest that years ago, ice could be found here, even in the heat of summer. Producer Roxy Todd recently visited Ice Mountain to find out if she could still spot some ice and to see the rare plant species that have existed there since the last ice age.
The hike begins at the base of Ice Mountain. Aside from the occasional car, the town of North River Mills is quiet. An old white house with a wooden porch is draped in the shade of three sugar maples. Across the street is a red barn that was built in the 1700s. I'm already dripping with sweat as I enter the forest and begin the hike.
Well, this little thermometer suggests that it looks like it's about 92-ish, 93-ish.
My guides are Rodney Barchus, who recently retired from the West Virginia Nature Conservancy, and Mike Powell, who now works as the land steward for the nonprofit group.
And we're headed up to Ice Mountain, a Nature Conservancy preserve. The preserve is open to the public, but we do ask that people go on one of our guided hikes.
Visitors are allowed to hike here, but only if they're accompanied by guides. Several trained volunteers take people on about 125 guided hikes a year. As we enter the forest, Rodney points to one recent change to Ice Mountain. Small ferns and other native plants are being crowded out by an invasive species called Japanese stiltgrass.
The natural world is changing in part because of changes that we are inadvertently making. We're making changes on purpose, and we're also making changes inadvertently, like bringing in the stiltgrass from Asia, which is now competing, and you can see it's just formed this thick carpet all over the forest floor.
He says stiltgrass is usually spread when visitors hike off the path, accidentally bringing the plant with them on their shoes or clothes. Garlic mustard and even tasty wine berries are also invasive.
I always encourage visitors to Ice Mountain and other places like this to eat as many wine berries as you can.
Mike's job includes organizing a few events each year to help get rid of some of the invasive plants to the forest.
They're just spreading faster than we have the ability to control them.
Which means the weeds are beginning to creep closer to the part of Ice Mountain where most of the rare plants live. Deeper into the forest, the canopy of trees grows thicker. Pine trees and rhododendron crowd the edges of the trail. There's more wildlife, too.
There's a Carolina wren singing that probably likes it because we're down near the creek. There was a few phrases from a wood thrush, a few phrases from a scarlet tanager I heard.
We hike along a creek. Ferns, white pine, and hemlock trees replace the invasive stiltgrass we saw earlier. After about 10 minutes, we pass our first ice vent. Actually, I feel it before I see it. Beside my leg, I feel a breath of cool air, like a refrigerator door is open. Then I see dozens of ice vents that vary in size. Some are as small as my hand, others I could stick my head into. It's kind of like a honeycomb with all these little holes in the hillside rocks.
And at those openings, you start to see and feel the airflow. And on a hot day like today, you can really feel a little bit of cool air being exchanged. And as Rodney mentioned, it becomes a lot more evident.
I go closer to one of the vents and put my face beside the cold air. And in a flash of inspiration, I put a can of seltzer water a few feet in to cool down. These ice vents probably formed thousands of years ago, at the end of the most recent ice age. Extreme, repeated temperature fluctuations between seasons likely cracked open the sandstone rocks in this mountain, creating crevices and holes as far as 50 feet. Rodney explains that water there freezes in the winter and is so well insulated that the mountain creates this underground refrigeration effect year-round.
In the winter, water can flow down through those rocks and kind of gets trapped. And when it's cold, it can freeze. in the cooler months, especially in the winter, cold air can also sink into those rocks.
Today, you can't find ice after April or May. But years ago, it never melted, even in the summer.
Ice Mountain was popular as a place for people to come and make ice cream, oh, at least until the 1920s, maybe into the 1930s.
As the years go by, Ice Mountain seems to lose its ice earlier and earlier each spring.
We're seeing change here, and what that change is associated with, you know, it could be a couple of different things, but we don't think that we're seeing ice accumulation in here as long as we did in the past.
Geologists haven't decided if climate change is responsible for the declining ice, or if it has something to do with people no longer carving out openings in the ice fence. Whatever the causes might be, the good news is that rare plants that have lived here for thousands of years are still thriving. And for now, the invasive species like garlic mustard and stiltgrass haven't moved into this part of the forest. Just a few feet from the largest ice vent are a handful of rare plants that Rodney points out.
This little plant here, some people call it dwarf dogwood, other people call it bunchberry. It is really a dogwood, but it's, again, only 3 or 4 inches tall. It has a beautiful white flower that looks just like the flowering dogwood that blooms in the spring that people are familiar with. So this is one of those northern plants that comes south through the mountains. In West Virginia, where you normally would go to see it, would be someplace like Dolly Sods or Spruce Mountain. But here it is, growing fairly commonly here around these ice vents.
There's also wild rose, partridge berry, oak fern, and a weird-sounding plant called skunk currant.
And if you put your hand down right there, you can feel, as soon as you get the hand down there, you can feel cold air coming up out of the ground where that skunk currant's living.
But the crowning jewel of Ice Mountain is the twin flower.
When it's in bloom, it'll send up a little stalk. It'll have two lovely trumpet-shaped purple flowers that dangle, and it's a very pretty plant.
When plants like twin flowers first appeared in this forest, ancient animals lived in these mountains.
The other things that were living here with the twin flower were caribou and ptarmigan, probably muskox, maybe even things like grizzly bears.
Rodney says he loves visiting places like Ice Mountain to see rare plants that mostly only grow in faraway places like Alaska or Russia or thousands of years ago.
I get to see things that otherwise I would have to be thousands of years away in time or thousands of miles away in distance to see here in West Virginia.
Before we head back, I go to check on my can of seltzer water.
And now she pops a celebratory cold one.
It was in the name of science. Mm-hmm. The temperature inside the ice vent is in the mid-40s. My water tastes amazing. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Hampshire County, West Virginia.
Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting and their podcast Inside Appalachia for that story. You can find more from their series about hidden gems in the mountains of Appalachia on their website, wvpublic.org. And thanks for listening to this week's Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. And don't forget about our Trump on Earth podcast. All of the episodes are at trumponearth.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.